Hey friends, this is Kike. I'm so excited to share this episode with you today. I got the chance to sit down with my good friends, Fu Lu and Rudy McCormick, and we discuss the Japanese concept, Ikigai. This is a concept that's really misunderstood in the West. We get into all the ways that it gets framed as this Venn diagram to think about how you can pursue a type of career or vocation or overarching life purpose, which intersects with what you're good at, what you can be paid for, what the world needs. And that's just not really what Ikigai is all about. We get into what it really means in this episode, from the thing that gets you up out of bed in the morning, finding the way that you can engage in a type of meaning or significance in the small things, in the quotidian aspects of life. It's not about how you can build a career or make more money for yourself. And we get into all of that in this episode. We have some clips from Ken Mogi, who's a Japanese neuroscientist who's written a book on Ikigai. We get into how Rob Bell has understood the concept, and we explore so much more. This is a great episode getting into everything from Zen Buddhism to how this concept might be a space of resistance in our current digital and capitalistic world. Yeah, we get into so much. I can't wait for you to get into this episode and to explore the various aspects of Ikigai. If you get a chance, please check out Fu's Substack, People of the Way. Check out some of the other episodes that I've done with Rudy on Eric Fromm. And if you get a moment, share this episode with someone who might benefit from it. And take the time to leave me a positive rating and review. That always helps. I hope that you enjoy this episode. And as always, I want to encourage you to continue the conversation. All right, guys, I am really excited about having this conversation with y'all. We're the Diamond Dogs, which is kind of a silly way that we refer to ourselves. We got this group text chain going where we just send each other sometimes really stupid shit, but sometimes really interesting ideas, and just support and encourage each other. So it's cool that when we get to come together and record some of these episodes. Nate, we miss you. I'm doubtful that you'll ever join us, you know, for an actual podcast, but we'll have to see.
He's a mysterious fourth party.
Yeah.
Who never shows up.
Yes. Like his response is, I want to, it's a maybe, but probably not.
He is probably the most active person on the Diamond Dogs text chat,
though. Oh, but that's a good point.
He makes up for it in other ways.
Okay, yes, good. Yes. I like that way of framing it. Okay. So I know that like the stated goal of this conversation is to discuss in some ways a concept that Fu has written about in his Substack, People of the Way. Ikigai, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I've been corrected multiple times, so I'm thinking I'm saying that right.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good. So Ikigai. And before we kind of jump into it, I'll just start by saying that I first heard about this concept from the American spiritual leader and author, used to be a pastor of a massive church, Rob Bell. He's kind of talked about it and spoken about it on multiple occasions. I'm not 100% sure if he's getting it accurate in light of some of the stuff, Fu, that you've helped me understand about the concept, but maybe we can get into that. And with that, I'll just say, and I know, Fu, you're going to talk about this in a moment, I've used this concept, sadly, incorrectly with a lot of my clients, using that Venn diagram, which you're going to get into, and helping people understand next steps in terms of where they're supposed to be going in their life. And yeah, maybe that's a place to start. Fu, help us understand the ways that this concept, Ikigai, gets framed in the West and often misunderstood.
Yeah, so I want to just start with a little disclaimer also that
sure.
I am not Japanese. So we will be saying some things in using Japanese terms throughout this podcast and trying to define those terms. So I know Ikigai by way of research, by way of my wife receiving that Venn diagram and showing it to me, and I'm looking at it and saying, that's curious, and then doing some research. And I do a lot of research into Asian, East Asian ideas. And so this, when I came upon this, it was of interest to me how the West has used this and how maybe the West has misused it. So let's just talk about what the word means, ikigai. Ikki in Japanese means life, and gai means value or worth. So one way to think about it is, what is your life worth? How do you value it? And then maybe framing it as meaning of life. What helps give meaning to your life? What helps wake you up in the morning and gives you meaning in life? So those are some ways to think about ikigai. But what I think you're alluding to is the Venn diagram, which some of your audience might be familiar with, which are these four circles that intersect, and they talk about love, what you love, what you're good at, what the world needs, and what you get paid for, and then in the middle, that's ikigai. In reality, that's really not ikigai. That's a way to sort of frame a person's purpose in life. And I kind of resist that idea of purpose in life, because that's a very broad and massive way to look at one's life. So if we think about, let's say, what the purpose is of a hammer. So we could agree that the purpose of a hammer is to do what?
To hit a nail on the head.
Okay, that's, and you could use a hammer for other things also, but that's by and large the purpose of a hammer. But when we apply it to human beings, that becomes sort of strange. And especially for someone who, let's say, needs help finding their purpose in life.
Yeah.
And if one does not immediately come upon that, there's just massive feeling of, well, I'm worthless. I failed in life. You know, I don't know what my life is about. And so and that's why I don't want to go there with this sense of purpose. Having a sense of purpose is important, I would say. And we have all probably experienced thinking about, you know, our sense of purpose in life, or have people come to us and talk to us, you know, working with students. You know, Rudy, you work with students too. You know that they could come to you and ask for their sense of purpose or calling in life. But that, again, that's a huge endeavor and something I don't want to start at, because ikigai is basically about how to make life meaningful wherever you are. And that's a little bit easier to understand, because there are a lot of things we could do immediately to have that ikigai in our life.
Yes.
And not have to sort of think about, like, what is our life's purpose, which is, again, this massive endeavor, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, ikigai has, you know, it has its multidimensionality. It's a lot more complex than how people are talking about it. And, you know, honestly, there's, we're going to get into it as we move along, but I'm excited to really, you know, like, unpack what the various aspects of ikigai actually contains, right? So we can really get to the nitty gritty.
And you said there was some intersection with Eric Fromm, and
there was, you know, Fromm, I think, could maybe look at ikigai as a kind of aspect of, you know, in the book that he wrote called, you know, To Have or To Be.
I was wondering about that. Yeah.
And then, you know, thinking really, like, it's closely similar to that concept of being that Fromm really harps on, and which is completely opposite to having. So being is actually something that you, one of the actual tenets of ikigai is actually, appreciating life, right? Mm-hmm. Just appreciating things for what they are, and being present in the moment. Actually, being contains a really, really similar aspect to that. To that point in Ikigai, which it's telling too, because from, in a sense, there's a way of being, right? And then also in which you can curate your life through Ikigai, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
that creates a sense of astuteness and wisdom, and almost like a caring, right? And like a sense of equanimity in life, mm-hmm. that I don't think really gets talked about as much, and it doesn't get the kind of popularity that maybe other concepts do. And I think maybe, that could be something that we could talk about.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
And I think, again, and I don't want to frame this as the opposition between West and East. there is a sense, though, in the West of I'm looking towards my future. I need to be this or that. I need to have a purpose in life. I need to, and that's the only way in order for life to be meaningful, et cetera, et cetera. And Ikigai sort of shrinks that all that might be important, but what are you doing in this moment right now? Yes. How are you appreciating this moment? And so one example that I used was making my morning coffee. Mm-hmm. And some of us have the same ritual.
Yeah,
right? I have French press.
And
I make espresso. So
I have an espresso machine too.
Yeah, and I have a French press in my office that I use every day.
Yeah, and so there is that ritual that I do just about every day, that I get up, I work on my writing for about hour and a half. Mm-hmm. Then we go walk the dogs, come back, and I make my coffee, and I fill in the mug and come back to my writing. And and those low moments I appreciate, because those moments get me to the next place. I look forward to those moments because they lead me somewhere. They lead me to a kind of curiosity or encounter or
so they transit. Yeah. Are these moments transitional spaces? Like, are they?
They're like, both.
Do they help you navigate
yourself? Yeah, they do. In themselves, they're meaningful, and they're meaningful because they lead me someplace else.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, because I actually was looking into, this might be a little off focus, but I'll try to bring it back to what you're talking about. I stumbled upon this idea of the third place. Have you heard of this? Have you heard of this idea of the third place?
No.
So this idea of the third place is like the first place is at least the way that it's curated or illustrated, is that the first place is the home, and then the second place is work, where most people tend to be the majority of their time. The third place is actually a place where people don't necessarily have to be, but it's a place where people can loiter, and it's a place where people can relax and chill and have conversations and basically do activities that have no purpose to them other than just enjoying the moment, right? So third places are actually very, very few and far between, and harder to find nowadays, especially in present moments. But you can find them specifically in like coffee shops and maybe going for a walk, doing activities that have no purpose to them, but just doing the activity itself, right?
That's good.
And I think there is a sense there that Ikigai probably runs through. But the reason I bring up third place, because the way you're talking about the activities you do throughout your day, it almost seems like these transitionary spaces are almost like third places, where they don't have a productive sense to them from the Western sense of the understanding, but they do have almost like a spiritual and I guess you could even call it a psychological reasoning for why you're doing them, because it gives you direction for how to like go about your day so that you can have a sense of not just narrative, but also like a sense of place, right? But yeah, I don't know what you think about the third place. Yeah.
So in Japan, there's a tea ceremony that can go on for several hours, and there's usually a little snack that goes with the tea. But the ritual of making the matcha tea is that, like you said, that third place where it, you know, in the West, we're like making tea for an hour. You know, it's like, what's that about?
Yeah.
Especially, you know, all of us, you know, live in the city and, you know, we know the hustle and bustle of life in Houston. And it's hard to comprehend having things that are meditative, are reflective, are in themselves not purposeful.
Yes.
You know, again, this is almost anti-purpose, you know?
Sure.
But they do lead somewhere, you know, but it's just immediately not so. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a question about the third space and, and how it connects to Ikigai possibly. I mean, I love that idea. And when you were talking about it, I don't know from where, but I realized I had kind of accessed kind of that term and I really like it. I think it's great. My question would be, as I'm understanding Ikigai more and more, part of what I really enjoy about it is that it's trying to say, you can do this special activity or this ritual, you can have this experience in the most mundane, quotidian aspect of life.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you don't have to go anywhere special or even to potentially a third space, which I'm not critiquing that, but
right.
I think I'm engaging in Ikigai in my like work office, which would be my secondary space,
sure.
right?
Yeah. yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe there's a bit of a tension there. As I am really for this concept of a third space. I think it's necessary.
We can also We can make the third space flexible, right? Like there's a flexibility to it. Maybe you can bring that into spaces. It doesn't have to be
bring
a
third
place.
Space exactly. into the second space. I like
exactly.
it. Yeah.
I mean, you know, not everyone has that privilege to be able to do that.
I think most don't.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. Yeah. But if you are in a space where you can. Curate the environment, because I think that's really important, like being able to have
absolutely
some kind of flexibility in how you can actually have, you know, some kind of control in an environment.
Sure.
Then you can actually, you know, create environments that have feelings of third places, right?
Yeah. Or
third spaces, whatever you want to call them.
Sure.
But yeah, I can see that. I can see that totally happening.
So what do y'all think about this? And here I'm probably... Well, I'm obviously a Westerner, so I'm probably falling into the trap of needing to offer a definition or to kind of reduce things. As y'all were talking, I started thinking, is Ikigai basically meaningful pleasure or meaningful enjoyment?
Mm.
What's wrong with that definition?
There is, yes. So there is part of it, and we can go through what... Ken Mogi would say would be just five pillars of Ikigai.
Sure.
But yeah, there is the first pillar is taking pleasure in the small things, right? Mm-hmm. The enjoyment of starting small. This is something that I can do. I don't have to be even great at doing it, right? So it doesn't require any talent. It doesn't require any skill.
That I really like. Mm-hmm. That I feel like is a very encouraging aspect of the definition.
Yeah.
Because it makes it so open to anyone.
Yeah. So in his book, and I'm getting a lot of this from his book, small book on Ikigai, but he gives an example of a sumo wrestler I think the sumo wrestler is from one of the Eastern Bloc countries, but immigrated to Japan and picked up sumo wrestling. And there's different levels. There's many levels of sumo wrestling. And the big guys that we usually associate and see, that's towards that last level there.
So are there like some skinny sumo wrestlers?
Yes, yes.
Oh my
and
gosh.
This guy, he's not skinny, yeah. but he's like that bantamweight, you know, sumo wrestlers. But the great thing about this dude is
I got to look that shit up, by the way, at some point. I can't wait to see a skinny sumo wrestler.
Yeah, yes. And that's how they start. And he is infamous for losing a lot. Okay. And so he's not like great at it, and he loses a lot, and he's on you. You know, people watch him to see him lose. Mm. Okay.
Interesting.
And so there's not like here, and we're so competitive. Like everything, like games are most often than not for competition.
Right.
Someone who wins.
Sure.
Whereas, again, not to overgeneralize, but in Japan, the competition is not a big deal. In baseball games, baseball teams will play to tie,
okay,
and that's honorable. Yeah, and to watch this one sumo wrestler lose so often shows that. For him, it's not about winning. And maybe he'll enjoy winning a game, winning a sumo match now and then. But for him, it's just the honor of being a sumo wrestler, what that comes with and the responsibilities and doing that.
Wow.
And so again, you know, in the West, we'll, you know, for someone like that, we'll probably sit them down and say, you know, maybe, you know, sumo wrestling is not your thing.
Right.
You know, maybe
right.
Baseball is not your thing if you can't hit the ball, you know?
Well, it puts less pressure on you to strive for, you know, complete mastery of what it means to be a sumo wrestler or like reach the highest heights.
Yeah. And probably like mastery for him means something different than like our sense of what mastery.
Yeah. Cause mastery for us is dominance, conquering, becoming first place, right? Like that's mastery for us.
Let's go there for a second. I mean, I know we're like just sort of speculating. Within the example that you were giving, Fu, like what could mastery look like for someone who's sort of known for losing?
Yeah. So again, it's the doing and receiving enjoyment out of.
Okay.
And just finding worth there in it. Have you guys ever watched, it was on Netflix, but now it's on Prime.
Mm-hmm.
It's a documentary called Jiro Dreams of Sushi about a famous sushi chef in Japan.
I gotta watch that.
Yeah,
he's a master in his own right. And in the documentary, he talks about growing up fairly wealthy. His father did pretty well as someone who took people on tours on his boat. Okay. And there's a photograph that he shows of him as a 9-year-old boy with his father. His father doesn't look anywhere like over 18 or 20. But sometime during Jiro's young life, his father lost the business. Something happened that he couldn't do the boat tours anymore, lost the business, and just was despondent and couldn't figure out what to do. And eventually just drank himself to death. I got a job at a military factory making, you know, machinery or whatever. But then Jiro, who's fatherless, picks up this vocation of making sushi. And the first thing any apprentice in doing sushi is not even making the rice. The first thing they teach you to do is to massage or beat the octopus.
Wow.
So you spend hours Whoa. Beating, of course, it's dead, but beating, tenderizing the octopus.
Right. Wow.
So you're in the kitchen, okay? And that's not a euphemism, by the way.
I was going to say, man, I'm thinking about so many things. I'm trying to hold it back.
But there is.
This is rated R, not X. So. Yeah,
and so that's how you start, okay, as a sushi chef. Mm. Like the rice is a very, actually is a very complicated thing to get
oh,
right.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. And so this is what Gerald had to do. But now he's a Michelin star chef, and one of his sons decided to take up the profession as a sushi chef. But his son knows that there is no way he can live up to the standards of the father. Mm. So he opened up his restaurant that is the complete mirror image of his father's restaurant. Is the exact mirror image. And the son is left-handed, by the way. So wow. If you take the two pictures and put them together, they look like one whole restaurant.
Wow.
Yeah. But the son knows that there's no way in his life, and he even says that he'll achieve the greatness of his father. But he still does it because again, there's this sense that, you know, this is something worth doing. Mm. Now, it's not worth doing because it's going to give me a Michelin star. That's just a matter of happenstance.
Okay.
That Jiro right. received a Michelin star. And I think two, you know, by the way. But it's just in the doing of the thing and finding the meaning in the thing, what Jiro's father couldn't get that he's getting.
So gotcha. Almost like the Michelin yeah. star is just a byproduct of you doing yes, what yes. you want to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you enjoying what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's, and then it's just like, you know what? If yeah. it just so happens that I do this long enough and I'm good at it, then people are just going to start recognizing that I'm doing something that I enjoy to do. And then it brings, for him, the soup, right? It brings people joy in eating the sushi. And it provides a certain kind of popularity.
In fact, the son says that a lot of people are intimidated to go to the father's restaurant and eat his sushi because the father is watching them eat the sushi and they're not getting that much enjoyment out of it because it's like prize win. Let's say you were given a slice of fish that's been looked over and has been treated in such a way that it's so prized, you know.
I wouldn't feel worthy eating it.
Yes, yes. So that's why they go to the son's restaurant,
yes.
you know?
Yeah.
And they could sit down in comfort and almost enjoy it more that
that's
way.
Nice. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. Okay, so here's kind of a thought in terms of the conversation. Before, I would love to get into all the different aspects of Ikigai, but maybe we could listen to this clip from Ken Moji. Is that how you say his last name? Who's actually from Japan. He's a neuroscientist. In this interview I was listening to, he's written over 100 books, which sounds incredible. But he has a few things to say about Ikigai, and then maybe we can kind of comment on it.
Yeah. Ikigai, quite simply, is the reason you get up every morning, because you get up in the morning and probably you start your day with a cup of coffee or tea, and you take your dog for a walk and so on. So it can be these small things in your daily life. But at the same time, Ikigai can be your life's ultimate goal, what you would like to achieve in your life. So it's something that is in the spectrum of small things and to the really big things. So mm-hmm. I think it's a very uniquely Japanese attitude to approach life from this spectrum of things, as opposed to the Western idea of, for example, 10 commandments.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Which describes really important aspects of our life.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you might actually miss something that is something small, but something that is very important in your life. So it's a realization that life is composed of these small things up to the really big things. That is, I think, the unique aspect of Ikigai.
So, yeah, so what do y'all say? I noticed that y'all laughed when he made the distinction between like the Eastern and Western understanding of things. And he talked about like the Ten Commandments, maybe something that represents a type of Western mentality. Like, yeah, what do you guys think about that kind of distinction that he makes there? Or what comes to mind?
Yeah. So, yeah, the Ten Commandments, you know, thinking about the notion of Moses going up to the mountain and bringing down these tablets and, you know, giving it to the Hebrew. And, you know, it's this huge epic narrative, right? You know, even thinking, and, you know, we all have the Charlton Heston, you know, Ten Commandments movie head, you know? And Ikigai seems to be on the other side of that. Not to say that, like, the huge things, the huge journeys are not important, but it's starting small. Yeah. You know, Mochi says that we might miss out, you know, on the little things in life if we're observing this epic narrative, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of thoughts that are going.
Yeah,
out
no,
in my
me
head.
Too. I'd love to hear what you say.
So, how do I maybe encapsulate? Because I could take things in various directions, but at least when it comes to the East West comparison, the Ten Commandments, for example, give you a sense of a grand narrative, right? Which the West is obsessed with, and then also it has a kind of staticness to it, right? There's this sense of like universality, and these are unchanging commandments, right? These are the things that are going to exist in perpetuity, right? And Ikigai is almost like the exact opposite of that. It's basically showing you how like appreciate the changes in life, and that's why you need to appreciate the little things, because it's in the little things
that
the bigger things have more meaning without the little things. So it has, in a sense, already baked in the sense of interrelatedness inside of it, which, for example, the Ten Commandments don't have, right? And then another thing that I kind of noticed that I thought was really interesting is just that in itself, the like Ikigai, like, I kind of want to ask Fu this, like I how much of Ikigai is related to Zen Buddhism? Because I'm noticing a lot of connections.
Yeah, I've wondered the same thing.
I want to see what you think about that.
No, and there is the context so culturally, I think Ikigai is much deeper, much older than Zen Buddhism, but there are definite overlaps.
Okay.
Right, between the two, that sort of the sense of the now.
Yeah, there's a sense of like both share this idea of mindfulness and being present in the moment.
Yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, because I noticed that. And I think one of the things that just struck out to me is I think this focus on the small things in life makes me wonder if there's a liberatory element to Ikigai, which runs counter to, you know, this attention-filled economy that we're in. Because I do think that people kind of overlook this, but attention's actually a currency now within the current mode of capitalism
that we're in,
right? And it almost seems like Ikigai gives you a sense of control back of your attention, because if you're not aware, your attention could be hijacked by the apps, by the technology we use.
Yeah.
And not that the technology is, maybe we've had these conversations before, but just to, you know, recap, like the technology itself is not the problem. It's the mode of logic that's used within the technology to capture our attention, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a you know, you can think of it as like there's a more sinister element, because there's a self-interested profit motive that exists within attention itself, which all these apps, however it is that you're using them, they're trying to capture and influence you, right? Suggestively. Yeah. They're trying to suggestively influence you into, you know, lending the attention in a product or lending the attention to the app or using your attention against you, where sometimes you're scrolling through some kind of social media app and then you're 2 hours in scrolling, you're like, what the hell's going on? Like, I just wasted 2 hours doing nothing, right? And there's no sense of ikigai in that activity, which I love for you to riff on if you, you know, if you'd want.
Yeah, so, yeah, there's in the ikigai, there is a type of attention and attunement to something, but it's moving away from, so there's a difference between letting something or capture our attention and then translate that into clicks, you know, and you know, that's like the marketplace is mentality that we've fallen into, right? That's what has sucked our attention. And then what the liberating part about ikigai is we're taking that attention, which is, you know, we know is valuable, highly valuable. If it wasn't, then, you know, big tech companies wouldn't, you know, use it, you know, use these apps to take it away from us. So when we're doing these things, we're noticing them, right? And we're changing, we're refocusing our attention to these things. So we're taking, you know, we're taking our freedom back, even our money, you know, because that's our time, right? Every time we attend to something, you know, that's time. That's time used on things. And and so when we make our morning coffee, we're using our time to do something that is very valuable for us,
right?
Right, and if we're paying attention to all these other thousand things, then in our mind it's like, okay, who has the time to make coffee? I can go to Starbucks, pick up coffee instead. Blah blah blah. You know, and it fuels, you know, that mentality.
So one of the things I'm thinking of, and I'm not feeling great about this distinction, but maybe you guys can kind of deconstruct it a little bit. But going back to the Moji clip, when he talks about the Ten Commandments versus Ikigai, I was just thinking, is he getting at maybe a distinction between something that's extrinsic versus intrinsic? And I guess to just unravel that a little bit, is Ikigai about kind of finding your own reason to get up out of bed in the morning, as many people have said? Is it about not needing something outside of yourself to tell you how to live your life? It's kind of the process of kind of figuring out what it is for you that brings you value. Now, my hesitation is that sounds really individualistic. I'm worried that I'm bringing kind of this Western like framework into it, which I probably am. But I wonder why he brought up the Ten Commandments. It's a very kind of externalized, you know, framework on top of a people versus, you know, you kind of have to figure out for yourself what it is that brings you meaning. And that's probably going to be different than the person next to you.
So the Ten Commandments can be looked at as these laws that are imposed on us, right? And if we violate them, that means all sorts of horrific things. And it's not that ikigai is somehow independent, because in a lot of ways, to appreciate the small things, we have to look beyond ourselves. We have to. It's almost moving, you know, beyond the self, beyond the ego, right?
And totally.
Because you know, again, a person can spend all their time thinking, oh, you know, what's my meaning and like, what's my purpose? You know.
Sure.
But then if you say, well, let's not think about that. Let's what is one thing that you can do right now that will bring pleasure in your life and connect you with other people? So is there one thing that you could do? maybe that is writing, maybe that's being out in the garden tending to some flowers. What is that one thing that we can start with?
So I don't know, Rudy, can you remember what you're going to say?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I'm thinking maybe I want to go back and restate something. Again, going back to the Ten Commandments reference, maybe another element could be like in terms of how Moji's making the distinction with the Ten Commandments. There's the modal verb or like the injunction to either not do something or to do, you know, it's a should,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
you must do X, Y, or Z. Whereas with Ikigai, I don't know that there is a should. There's no, this is the way it has to be. It's just a whole different framework for thinking about yourself and your activity in the world. It's about that kind of meaningful enjoyment rather than fulfilling a command.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It almost feels like the best way to frame Ikigai is to talk about what Ikigai is not. So mm-hmm. in the negation of what Ikigai is gets you closer to Ikigai.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you remember what you were going to say?
I did.
Okay.
Reinforcing what Fu was really saying about this idea is like activities you do individually that lead towards, you know, more community connection within people.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the little things you do, like I think about it in my life, like the small practices of habits that lead me to having, you know, better mental health for myself. It's with those small practices that I can come into community and then be, you know, a shoulder for someone to cry on.
Yeah.
Or, you know, be a rock for someone because I'm taking care of myself by doing the little things.
Yeah.
The Ikigai in my life so that I'm good in a space where maybe someone isn't, or maybe someone is showing moments of weakness or showing, you know, crisis, and you can be in a sense prepared for those moments because you've done the Ikigai, you know, these navigated transitional experiences that you're going through so that you can create connection and community, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it gets overlooked. It's not something that's sexy. Like, it's not a sexy thing to do at all.
No.
It's kind of like when people talk about like, oh, you know, what is love? And people really think about, oh, it's the butterflies in your stomach. But it really is like, maybe love is just like doing laundry with your partner.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's
driving
stuff,
to HEB,
right?
And picking up my wife's medication when I really don't fucking want to.
Exactly. And that maybe is rooted in
Amy doesn't listen to this.
Yeah, she doesn't. She gets bored.
But in a sense, that is a kind of Ikigai, right? That we're doing for one another, and it's creating connection. And that, you know, in a sense goes back to, you know, bringing him from just to like put him in and connecting it all, a sense of relatedness.
Yeah.
That comes from these individuated practices that seem to appear like they're individual, but they're actually not. They're actually helping us to actualize ourselves in spaces of community if we're able to have them. Right?
Yeah, that's good. Fu, you got something that's coming up?
Yeah, I just wanted to, what you were saying, Rudy, reminds me of this scene from a movie that I saw the other day, and it was about putting together puzzles.
Okay.
And so I maybe I could find the quote from that movie but you guys could talk.
Well, okay, so how about this? But while you looked that up, one of the things that I did want to throw out there was, again, I have another clip that I'd want to play.
Sure.
Because I think most people, or a lot of people that know what they're talking about when it comes to Ikigai, they highlight that there's no like one English way to translate it. But many of them, including Moji, will say it's like the reason that you get out of bed in the morning. And so I just want to play this clip from Rob Bell just to kind of honor him for a second, because that's where I first heard the concept, even though, Fu, as you pointed out, he mispronounces the word. Yeah. But I think he has maybe some interesting things to say about it that maybe could spark some more conversation.
Sure.
Unless, Fu, you've found the quote. Did you find the quote?
Yeah.
Okay, so why don't you say it, and then maybe we can play the Rob Bell clip.
Then we could go with Rob Bell. So it's a movie about, I'm not going to give everything away, a woman who just tries, she's not satisfied with anything happening in her life, much less her marriage and family. But she encounters this one very successful entrepreneur who he's at a point where all he is about is going to get a puzzles. And so he puts up a sign to see if he could get someone to help him put together these puzzles. And she finds them through the sign. Anyways, so there's a scene and they're sort of at the apex of their relationship together, and her name is Mata. So I'll read what he says to her.
Yeah.
He says, "Life is messy. It doesn't make any goddamn sense. Sorry to break the news to you. Life's just random. Everything's random. My success, you here now, there's nothing we can do to control anything. But when you complete a puzzle, when you finish it, you know that you have made all the right choices. No matter how many wrong pieces you try to fit into a wrong place, but at the very end, everything makes one perfect picture. What other pursuits can give you that kind of perfection? Faith, ambition, wealth, love? No, not even love can do that, Mata. Not completely."
Wow.
Yeah.
There are things that we can do, like trivial things, like putting together a puzzle that can bring some meaning into our lives, that can help us connect with other people. And like, what if, like, we found those things and we started there? And again, we don't have to, seek God on this mountaintop and bring down these things.
You know what's funny?
That may be part of the journey, but that doesn't have to be, the journey.
Totally. That actually reminds me of
great point.
I remember reading Alan Watts' book. It's not a book. It's like a series of lectures that he had, but they turned it into a book. It's called Out of Your Mind. And there's actually like a specific analogy that he has, which is similar to this puzzle, but it's actually, he talks about embroidery. Because the front of the embroidery actually has, this image that's, it looks like it's in harmony. It looks like it has meaning. It has purpose. It's creating something that you can actually understand. But if you actually look behind the embroidery,
it doesn't make any goddamn sense.
It's chaotic. Right? It's chaotic. Yeah, right? Exactly. It's a chaos of different kinds of strings put together, but it actually on the other side creates an incredible image, right? And I think that's what you're getting at.
I think so.
It sounds great. Okay, so I know in a moment, maybe Fu, you could talk about these five things that Ken Moji highlights in terms of what Ikigai is. Mm-hmm. But before that, maybe I can play the clip and we can like riff on what we think Rob Bell is getting at.
Then I stumbled on this Japanese word, Ikigai. And Ikigai essentially is that which gets you out of bed in the morning. And sometimes it's translated your reason for being. And in Japanese culture, they have this very well thought through idea of Ikigai, that you never stop working out your Ikigai, what it is that gets you out of bed in the morning. And so in this season of life, this is what you're doing, but that may change. It may shift. Somebody you love may get sick, and so you need to care for them. You used to do this, and now that industry is sort of dried up, but now you need to go back to school because you need to now go do this. And they had this really interesting idea that when you no longer have something that gets you out of bed in the morning, then you're kind of dead, even if you're still alive. And the reason why I find that fascinating is you can be successful, you can have a nice job, you can have a nice house, you can do all the stuff that everybody says, hey, you've made it, and yet wake up in the morning with a profound sense of dread, like, ugh, another day. And despair Despair is a spiritual disease. Despair is when you believe that tomorrow will simply be a repeat of today. Despair is when you look ahead into the future and each day is just another version of this. What we really want, no matter how educated, sophisticated, accomplished we are, we want to wake up in the morning with this sense of anticipation, like, look what I get to do today. The great Abraham Joshua Heschel said, I didn't ask for success, I asked for wonder.
That gave me goosebumps, man.
No, that's that good. Great. Yeah. Yeah. I think he really got to the meaning of it, even though he mispronounced it.
Correct, yeah.
No, okay, how so? Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, so, you know, going back to that image of those puzzle pieces, right, we don't know exactly how things fit in, but we keep on working at it, right? And we work on it and work on it. And finally, you know, we get the big picture of it. But it's not in the ending, the big picture, that's the real enjoyment. The real enjoyment is, aha, I found a piece that goes here, right? Mm. And that's the ikigai part. And that is what breaks us out of that cycle. As soon as he said, you know, the cycle, I think of Nietzsche's idea of recurrence. You know, Kierkegaard has the same idea, where, you know, things repeat itself, and in a lot of ways that can become hellish, right?
Yeah.
Right. That.
Yeah.
That
the myth of Sisyphus, just pushing up the boulder, starting all over
exactly.
again.
Exactly. And so many people, you know, I myself included, have been caught in cycles where, like, I'm doing the same thing, you know, each and every day.
Yes.
And when does it end? And I try to find places of meaning in that, but it just it's just hard to do. And so going back to this sense of, you know, are there other things we can do that can get out of and it's hard. It is hard in our, especially our Western worlds, when our systems that we create have been set up that way,
yeah.
where we repeat, right? We rinse and repeat.
Yeah.
And that's how we make life work here.
9 to 5, Monday through Friday, and then weekends, and start over again, yes, baby.
Exactly. And I can see why
you know,
there is that despair, you know, that there is no wonder in those days. Mm. We don't have to struggle. We don't have to be inventive. We don't have to really pay attention to these details that are really important, that in the end will make sense. But now it's just we're working through,
sure,
figuring things out, you know. And so that's where the despair is. And, you know, then the question is, how do we get people, like, out of this cycle of despair?
Yeah. And
totally.
It's interesting because you can also look at the recurrence and take a completely different orientation to that. And say that, well, you know, it's through the constant habit of trying to do something over and over,
mm-hmm,
that gives you mastery over it.
Right? Yeah.
Right? So it's like, well, how do you become good at something? You have to fail at it a lot.
Yeah.
Right? And that's
and
then
good.
As you fail, as you keep failing, you'll eventually do something right. And then when you do that right, then you feel like accomplished. Yeah. Accomplishment has appeared now, right? And then that's part of the recurrence, right? It just really depends on kind of like our mindset, right? And our the word that I'm really thinking about here, and I kind of talk about this with my students, was like self-efficacy. Like, what is your self-efficacy in the way that you look at striving?
Yeah.
The things you're trying to achieve in the world, they only happen if you create a practice to habitually do them over time. And then you only get better at something if you keep repeating it.
Mm-hmm.
If you may have talent, right? Like, you know, you might be like a basketball player that's really good, like LeBron James or something like that. And you just have the natural talent. But if you don't practice shooting, if you don't practice free throws, if you don't practice the small minutia of moving your body in a specific way, you're not going to be the best player possible to really help out your team, right? I mean, that's just an example, but really what I'm getting at is it's through the recurrence of repetition.
Yeah, that repetition,
there is a space for wonder, right? There could be.
Yeah.
Not that there is, but there could be, right?
If you're allowed to go there. But yeah. So few people are allowed to go there. Like, yeah. Like our jobs are programmed in a way to meet these certain, you know, criteria, right? You know, to benchmarks or whatever. You know, so someone observes us. You know, and well, see it's if because we meet the Ten Commandments or
well,
not.
Well, see, this right? is where I was wanting to make the distinction between the extrinsic and intrinsic. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of the eternal recurrence, when you feel like it's forced upon you,
right?
Then
right.
it's like hell.
Yeah.
But if it's something
you choose
that somehow comes with this like agency and self-efficacy, yeah. mm-hmm. then that can be a space for, I think, what you were talking about.
Yeah.
There's a person who he makes these small burgers. It's a $3.55 burger.
Okay,
they're gourmet burgers. I've seen them.
Is it here in Houston?
No. It's in I think it's in California, but he start off. I'll figure out where it is. But he starts off as managing a grocery store. Then he takes part of the grocery store. You know how most grocery stores right now, they have a kitchen. You know, you could get prepared foods there.
Sure.
And so he figures out how to make these burgers that look absolutely delicious, cheeseburgers. And, you know, he throws these fresh onions on them while they're grilling. And these buns, like, they look like, you know, brioche buns. It looks delicious. And he sells them for $3.55. But, that's you know, awesome. He doesn't care about, you know, the margins or markup. But let's say we put him in a McDonald's, okay, where he has to make these damn whatever.
Uniformed burgers,
uniform
right?
burgers yeah. that yeah. come out of the freezer that, right. you know, every day, okay? You know, how soul crushing it would be for him to do that kind of recurrence, okay, day after day.
Right.
But here, yes. He looks like he's pretty young. He's probably he's Asian, so he's probably in his 30s. But he's been doing this for quite a while, and he has a sense of mastery because this is something he came up with. He was allowed to come up with. He invented it. This is how much he charged. He doesn't care, you know, if he makes money off of this. And people go there and they'll buy three or four at a time and just like really enjoy these burgers. You know, that there is a difference in that.
Okay. Yeah.
So one of the things that's coming up for me is how would you guys... If there is, I think there is a distinction, an important distinction between these two concepts. Maybe it's a West-East thing. And Rudy and I have talked about how I feel like the rampant, unreflected life philosophy of so many younger people is just kind of this technological hedonism. Yeah. How is that just kind of seeking pleasure different than what we've been talking about as ikigai? Maybe there's some overlap, but I think there's some important differences too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's the meaning, right?
That's what I think too.
Yeah, it's the meaning. Let's go through these five pillars.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Then we could reflect on them and sort of talk about the difference between this technological hedonism and ikigai. So the first one is starting small and focusing on details. The second is releasing yourself, meaning to accept who you are. So accepting the possibility of failure, the possibility that you suck at this, whatever a possibility there are in that.
Dude, that almost seems impossible today in light of like Instagram and social media, right?
Exactly.
Where the exact opposite sensibility is encouraged.
Yes, to fail in that way, to be allowed to fail in that way. Harmony and sustainability is the third one, in relying on others. The fourth one is the joy of little things, appreciating sensory pleasure, like you know, we popped open these beers, Ghost in the Machine beers. Hopefully they can sponsor us.
Which is, Parrish Brewery. Yeah,
if you're listening, you're my favorite brewery of all time. Please sponsor us. I'll drink your beer all the time.
Yeah, before the show and after. So we've been enjoying these IPAs and just you talking about, you know, flavor and ingredients used and things like that.
Yeah.
And there is a, with anything, you know, there's alcoholism, but there's the enjoyment of these things like that. And then there's being in the here now, really, that you're talking about this,
like the mindfulness aspect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Finding your flow, when you are in the here now.
Yeah.
So are there activities in life where you're just putting yourself so into the activity that you forget about time, forget about place, and it's automatic for you? There's this one psychologist. His name is Mihai. Shizen Mihai.
I'm so glad you did it. I can't pronounce that guy's name.
Mihai, where he talks about this flow state. Have you heard about this, Rudy? Where you heard of flow states.
Yeah.
Put yourself into it, and it's where it's challenging enough for you that it doesn't get boring, but it's not too challenging where. You will feel like a complete failure if you, and it's just enough tension there where you can do something and put yourself, and it become automatic.
Right.
You achieve it automatically.
That's good.
There's a sense of flow where you're, like, you know, you're in flow when you don't feel like you need to think about the next step.
Yeah.
The step is already unfolding in front of you. You're just like, almost like in a way, like letting go and just accepting what's happening in the moment. And you're just, some people say that, you know, time slows down as you're in flow. And then this aspect of just being in the deep now, right? Yeah. I think it's what's being called. And you perform at your best and you have this complete sense of well-being as you're in this flow state. So, I mean, athletes do it, you know. I mean, athletes experience it through physical activity, but you could also experience it through, you know, mindful meditation, through deep practices of mindfulness that you do over a prolonged period of time, right? That you can also experience flow as well. And then also too, like, funny enough, like the movie The Matrix, well, maybe not the movies, but the universe of The Matrix actually personifies the concept of flow in a way that, so if you ever saw The Animatrix, it's a movie that was made that actually shows you the origins of how The Matrix was made, and you see the whole war between the machines and the humans. But when the machines win the war, because humans basically, you know, humans and machine like went to war with one another, and then eventually like they use humans as batteries because humans blotted out the sky. It's a great movie if you want to watch it, or it's just a great universe to get into. But then once that happened, there were humans who were capable of escaping the Matrix, or like glitching out of it through states of flow, which is kind of interesting. And they were able to wake up and realize that they're in this ooze that's turned into the mechanism to create the batteries for the machines to be able to power themselves. So flow is also a way of, you know, metaphorically speaking, through the Matrix, they're basically saying it's a way to escape the simulation of the life that we've been, or that has been created for us through our society, right?
Yeah.
It's actually a way to see beyond the veil is what it's saying.
That's good.
Yeah.
So, okay, so could we, for just a second, and maybe as we draw to a close, like reflect on, and maybe I'm creating a bit of a sharp distinction, but I think as anyone who's listening, they're, you know, more than likely, although I think there's people all over the world that listen to this, but more than likely kind of coming from a Western mindset, I could see someone thinking, okay, ikigai is a type of just kind of finding what makes you happy in life and doing more and more of that. How is that different than, I mean, I know I kind of coined the term digital hedonism. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a better way to frame that, but just pursuing a life where what you're primarily interested in is just kind of feeling good or experiencing pleasure. How are these two things different? Because I think they are.
I mean, Fu, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't actually think ikigai is about happiness.
Yeah,
I don't think meaning and happiness are the same thing, right? Like that's.
I would totally agree.
Yeah.
Go for it.
At least happiness in the way that most Westerners tend to think of it is like a.
Well, a Benthinian, right? Like, maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. Like, that's not what we're talking about. That's not what ikigai is talking about at all.
Yeah. Taking pleasure in the small things in life is not that, you know. You go out and you seek things that are pleasurable, right? But you tackle things that are perhaps in your mind not so pleasurable, and then you find pleasure out of that.
That's good.
So,
the guy that loses all the time.
Yes. A sumo wrestler, and you know there are many things that the Japanese have done that you know can be used as examples, like. So the Japanese have great whiskeys. Okay, and so
we're gonna drink some later.
I shared some with y'all last time.
It was amazing.
I was here and I got into Japanese whiskeys maybe about 5 years ago or so. Just some of the most amazing whiskeys, but they didn't start out like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it started out by just curiosity. Like, what if we could buy barrels from Scotland and ship them to Japan and start out by analyzing, you know, how they made whiskey and make our own and perfect that, you know, and it took many, many years to do that, many tries. But the idea was not to have to... the award-winning whiskey of the year. It was never that idea. And by the way, I have one bottle of award-winning whiskey of the year.
Nice.
That's a Japanese whiskey. And it's amazing. But that's not how you start out. Mm. And there's a lot of things that have been done in Japan that people would spend years and years, and there's seemingly no... product, no visible, tangible outcome or product. There's just one way to make pottery with these beautiful designs, and the method had been dead for centuries, and many people have tried to revive that particular way to make it, and none have really been successful. And these. If you could find one of these ceramic pieces, they're millions of dollars. But people have invested their lives in trying to replicate that way of doing ceramic pottery, and to date, none have been successful.
Wow.
But the process in itself is what leads to pleasure for some of these people. You know, that exploration. You know, that journey, and so. Again, I don't think a lot of our teens, you know, if we said, no, let's do something that won't give you any pleasure or reward immediately, okay?
They would
go for it, okay? You know, I you know, show me that teen and
right,
be like,
right,
yeah,
no.
Okay, they're on the path to, you know, to becoming the next Buddha or whatever. That's not something we value much in the West.
No.
That in the East, you see it in Lapa, you see it in South Asia, Southeast Asia a lot, where people would invest their lives in exploring just things that don't immediately yield any value. Mm. But in a way, there's so much value there in the exploration.
Yeah. Oh, so good. Okay. You know, I think I've come to the end of the questions that I had. Either you, Fu, or Rudy, is there any kind of final thoughts that you have to kind of close out the episode?
Yeah, it's... I guess one of the things that, you know, it's just lingering there in the ether is how, you know, we talk about the East and the West, but, you know, I always think about, like, I wonder how the West itself, as it's globalized its values into the East itself, how it's also in a way managed to influence the East to try to move away from these actual more traditional understandings of what value actually is. Yeah. And how it's actually, it probably already is. I know Japanese culture has changed since, you know, after World War II. It's been a completely different society has changed over time. I know they're still traditional in certain senses, but I wonder if they still, if the majority of the population or the majority of society values these sorts of concepts like Ikigai, for example.
No, that's a really good thought and question.
Yep.
Because, you know, what we're seeing in the East is the expansion of capitalism, right? Industry and capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
What the East has done is, yes, you know, and especially in places like Korea, you know, they've taken on so much of Western culture, and so much of it is, to me, grotesque.
Oh, right.
You know,
where, right.
You know, women would change their features to look more like Westerners, wow. You know, through surgery and things like that. And it's like, but there's also because of Ikigai and other things, ways to preserve the doing things for their own sake and not for other sake. So, you know, for example, Toyota. I just pulled in with in a brand new Toyota.
A really badass white Tacoma.
Tacoma.
Such a Tacoma. Fucking TRD.
Yeah, but yeah. Yes, exactly. It's a sports package.
Yeah, and, man.
I'm doing very well as a writer. Okay, anyone listening? No. So there's a long story behind that. But anyway... That's okay. There was a time where Toyota cars in the U.S. were looked down at.
Yeah,
okay, right. Yeah. And now it was very hard to get that particular truck because there was only two models that came out this week, and like within 24 hours, both were sold. And so the demand is really high now for particular things from Japan, and all that's to say that one thing that I value about Eastern culture is there's two things can be held in tension.
Yeah. It's like space for paradox.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be a binary choice between, you know, capitalism and Ikigai. You know,
there's a sense of non-dualism.
Yeah. So they could, you know, make cars, produce cars, sell them, and make them very good.
Yeah.
You know, and put a lot of effort in thinking about design and thinking about form and thinking about functionality and, you know, all those things.
Sure.
We're about, you know, what can we produce to get money?
Right.
You know, yes, that's a concern. And that, you know, Vietnam is like that. It's a very capitalistic country, even though it's a communist country.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there is a sense if you visit Vietnam, and have some of the food, even the street food, there's a sense of I can wow. make you the best banh mi you know you can ever have and it's true. The first day that I had street food in Vietnam back 5 years ago, went there, just saw banh mi vendor, bought just plain cold cuts, just banh mi. It just melted in my mouth.
Wow.
It just, okay, that person, you know, she didn't wake up thinking, oh, you know, I gotta have a banh mi empire, you know, $5 each, or, you know, a banh mi is like $8 actually now, right, at Wustar. But she just woke up and said, this is something I want to make, and I want to make well, because people will be eating this. Yeah, putting so this in their bodies.
That's a good point.
Yeah. You know? And I have is this cart on the street.
Yeah. So you're saying, like, even though the Western influence has been very strong, there's still a deep sense of Ikigai within the East.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like mutated itself in different ways.
Yes. And I don't think it'll ever go away, because it is something that is meaningful, that gives people, you know, this ground in life. Mm. Like, there's so many things that, you know, we do that, like, are gone and we forget, you know? But that these things linger on throughout our lives. This is something we can do, like, even in retirement, even if we don't have anything to do, this is still something to do. And I think that's where the hope is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 100%.
Yeah, for your clients, for the young people who we meet, you know, every day, who sort of wondering, what do I do in my life? What's my vocation? What's my calling? What's my life's purpose?
I kind of see it as a type of resistance. Mm-hmm. When I, even though I'm fortunate to have a lot of autonomy and freedom and just a lot of meaning in what I do as a therapist, there are aspects that, you know, are the monotonous and mm-hmm. that type of, like, eternal return that's more vicious than life-giving. When I make the coffee in the French press in the morning, or I do this podcast, or I sit down and work on a puzzle with one of my kids, I see that as a way to not engage in, like, the capitalist machine and to be told how I should live my life or what I should be doing. It's a space where I can have that meaningful pleasure and live out my humanity, I think, in a healthy way.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because even, I mean, a lot of us kind of, you know, all three of us are privileged to have, you know, certain kinds of careers that we've chosen that gives us that, there's a space in it to be creative.
Yes.
Even if there
it's encouraged, right?
Yeah. Even if there is, like, an eternal return, right?
Sure.
Where, you know, for example, there's classes that one has to teach us, for me specifically.
For me, it's fucking paperwork.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, I got to do, like, bureaucratic paperwork too, right? Like, end of the year reviews and these things, all that stuff. And then also, too, like, there's even aspects of teaching classes that become repetitive.
Absolutely.
Over time.
Yeah.
But the thing that I like to do is that when there's that sense of repetitiveness is to startle it. Like, that's what I like to do. Mm. I startle the repetitiveness by maybe doing something different in a moment it's not always going to happen.
Sure.
It's not always going to, because there's moments where I'm like, man, I'm really tired and I just need to get past this moment.
Yeah.
I need to get past this point. So I'm just surviving there, right? It's a sense of, like, I need to get past it. But when you're a little more wholesome and you have more space to carry things, in those moments of, like, maybe I could just keep doing the same thing that I'm doing, but now I could actually do something else. And then in those spaces, you could actually create a sense of spontaneity.
Absolutely.
Right? And then maybe ask different questions or do some kind of, like, active or engaging activity within, at least, for example, with me in classrooms, I can do those things. So it doesn't always have to be me lecturing. I can, you know, see what students are thinking. So there's a sense of when you have the flexibility to do other things in the workspace, then it doesn't always have to lead towards the monotony,
right? So okay, I know I wanted to kind of come to a close, but I'm sort of thinking, right, Albert Camus reflects on the myth of Sisyphus, and he basically says, you know, we have to imagine Sisyphus happy. Could there be a sense in which we have to imagine Sisyphus as engaging in a type of ikigai? What would that look like? I don't know.
That'd be great. That'd be great. I don't know if he's smiling, but
if he can find meaning in rolling that rock, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I think there needs to be a time, though, where we all would have to reevaluate our lives, right?
Yeah.
Imagine, like, is this worth that? You know, is is this type of reoccurrence, is that valuable enough for me to not engage in happiness in other ways, or
that's a good
meaning in other ways.
Sure.
And so, you know, that's for everyone to decide, right?
Yeah,
I can't decide because my life is formatted in such a way. You know, I don't want to ever impose like my life onto anyone else's life. But I think, you know, every time that there's a point of pain, there's a point of despair, that should be a flag for us, right? To say, hey, we need to reevaluate and figure out, you know, can we infuse moments of ikigai in our lives, or there is not enough liberation for us that we need to do something else? You know, again, that's all for someone else to decide, not me.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, for Sisyphus, I would ask that. You know, when is rolling the rock not meaningful anymore? Right. Where you just have to stand aside and let it fall, and you go, you know, and live in a different kind of life.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's good. Because, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, from what he's saying, I'm constantly reevaluating my life.
it's a constant thing. Yeah, and the thing is, not everyone has the privilege like we do to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's right.
But I can tell you though that most listeners of this podcast, and most people who we know in the West, probably can do it.
Yeah.
And do it with not a lot of bad consequences.
Okay.
You know, right?
Like it may take some imagination, but.
Yes. And but.
An ingenuity, right?
Exactly. But it's not like, you know, someone who's stuck somewhere, you know, and cannot find their way out of that, has to live that kind of life, you know.
Totally.
Yeah, you know, I think that's what Camus is is thinking of.
Sure, you know? Sure. Yeah, no, I agree. Well, guys, this has been awesome. I feel like I've learned a lot. Just thank you for the conversation.
I appreciate it. Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, could I teach you guys one other Japanese word? And this is Japanese for cheers.
Yeah,
it's kampai.
Yeah,
you know it. Okay, ready. Yeah. Okay, so we can say cheers to y'all.
Kampai.
Kampai.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you.